When someone says that something went the way of the dodo, you know that it means that it disappeared. And I guess with all due respect to the dodo, the story of the passenger pigeon is an even more incredible story of abundance, decline, and extinction. And it's one with strong ties to Wisconsin, as a matter of fact. Errol Fuller is an acclaimed artist and writer, world authority on bird and animal extinction. His many books include Lost Animals, Extinction and the Photographic Record, Extinct Birds, and Dodo, From Extinction to Icon. His most recent book is The Passenger Pigeon, and he joins us from his home in England. Errol, welcome to the program. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you.
Maybe we could start, and your book is lovely, and just an absolutely fantastic cover, along with wonderful, some of the rare photos of the passenger pigeon inside. But for those who have yet to see your book, or have yet to see what a passenger pigeon looks like, maybe you could describe it for us today. How similar is it to, not so much to pigeons, maybe mourning doves, but how similar is it to the pigeon, for example?
Well, if you think of an ordinary pigeon, it was a very kind of slimmed down, streamlined version of an ordinary pigeon. You know, the ordinary wood pigeon is quite a dumpy sort of thing, really, whereas the passenger pigeon was very elegant, very beautifully coloured. It had sort of various shimmers and gleams and glosses all over its plumage. So it was a very, very elegant bird. It definitely looked like a pigeon, but if you can imagine a pigeon much more slender than any other pigeon that you've ever seen.
More like a mourning dove.
Yeah, very like a mourning dove, but much bigger.
Yes, yeah. We got this question not long ago from a listener about where the name passenger pigeon comes from. What's the origin of that?
I think it's sort of French in origin. It kind of means to travel or passage. Doesn't actually mean passenger, like someone that rides a train. It kind of means to move on, as it were. And I think it comes from the French originally, and then a sort of corruption of the French.
And what was the range of the passenger pigeon?
Well, it was really just North American, and on the eastern side of the northeastern parts of the United States and on into Canada. And, of course, Wisconsin was very important to it, and in fact, in my book, I published a series of more than 20 photographs of living passenger photographs that were taken when the passenger pigeon was still alive, and those photographs only really survive, or most of them only really survive, because of the Wisconsin Historical Society, which has somehow acquired them many years ago and has preserved them and made them available for anyone that wants to see them or use them. And they very, very kindly allowed me to use them all in my book.
Yeah. The Wisconsin,
is kind of central to the passenger pigeon in my mind, even though I live in far away in England. You know, Wisconsin is almost the most the center of passenger pigeon research, as it were.
Yeah, and the Wisconsin Historical Society, you're right, it is a wonderful, wonderful place. And not just several hundred yards from where I'm sitting right now, as a matter of fact. So,
is it? Well, I've never been there, but I just corresponded with them by mail and by email, and they were so helpful with everything.
Maybe you could describe for us how incredibly plentiful passenger pigeons were when the European settlers came to North America.
Well, if we just take, let's just say the start of the 19th century, let's say 1800, the birds lived literally in billions. And when they did their great migratory flights, they darkened the skies, blotted out the accounts say they blotted out the sun. And some of these flights, massed flights, would stretch for miles and miles and miles. There are all sorts of estimates of how many individuals there were, but they're really quite meaningless. All you can say is there were billions and billions of the things. And then, there seemed to be no real change in the numbers right up until the 1860s. I mean, we don't know if that's true, if the numbers were declining. But there seemed not to be any great change. And then from, say, 1870 onwards, suddenly the numbers plummeted until by 1914 there was just one individual still living in a cage in the Cincinnati Zoo.
Yeah, it's...
So it was... I mean, you introduced it, the subject, by mentioning the dodo a little earlier. And the dodo, of course, is incredibly famous. But the extinction of the dodo was nothing like the extinction of the passenger pigeon. First of all, we don't know how many dodos there ever were. It may not have been particularly common. Second, it lived on a very small island, Mauritius, in the Indian Ocean, which is only perhaps 40 miles wide by 30 miles long. So it had a very restricted area that it lived in. So it was a relatively big and fat bird that couldn't fly. Yeah. So it was really easy to hunt and exterminate in that way, whereas the passenger pigeon is an altogether different and more amazing example of extinction.
You know, one of the fascinating aspects of this for me is that it wasn't just their numbers, but it was their roosting behaviors that really made them a formidable presence. Maybe you could talk about that.
In my book, I wrote about the effect it must have had on farmers and just people in general. I mean, no one knew where the passenger pigeon was going to come to or go to. It just suddenly arrived in an area in its billions, landed on the trees and anywhere it could land, and just completely obliterated the landscape. And if you were a farmer at that time... Your crops could have been absolutely ruined. Your water holes that you got water from could have been completely fouled. It could just have absolutely ruined your livelihood.
Yeah.
And then after a couple of weeks, they all flew off and were gone and may never have come back. Or they may have come back the next year. You just didn't know. So it really was a great kind of force of nature.
And when they nested, they really relied, I think, didn't they, on sheer numbers just to keep the fledglings alive?
Yeah, well, you know, this is people have often sort of, many people have been mystified by why couldn't the birds survive in small numbers? I mean, just so that listeners that don't know will get a grasp of this thing, that people, the passenger pigeon basically was trapped and shot in the most unimaginable numbers. And until the numbers have declined to a certain level. People then have wondered, well, there might have been a million of them left. Why couldn't they still survive? But their nesting system seems to me, and I think I'm really the only person that has thought of this, the nesting system, I think, gives that game away, because what the birds used to do was... have an egg, they hatch the egg, then after, I think, 12 or 13 days, all the adults just flew off at once, leaving the baby bird in the nest. It would call for a day or so, then it would climb out of the nest and fall to the forest floor, where it would stay for 2 days because it couldn't yet fly. After 2 days, it would be able to fly off. Now, you can imagine that if there's billions and billions of these babies lying on the forest floor, the local predators come along and gobble them up, but they can only gobble so many. Soon, the local predatory population is satisfied, and there are still millions of birds left. Now, if you extrapolate that down to a population of perhaps 100 birds or 200 birds nesting in a forest, the adults all fly off, the chicks fall to the floor, 200 birds, 200 chicks, what's going to happen? The local foxes and other predators are going to come, and very soon they're going to find them all and eat them all. So the numbers don't work in if they're reduced to a small level. They only work if there are millions and millions and millions of birds.
Yeah, that's an interesting, and boy, that makes a lot of sense when you think about it. There's actually an effort underway. We had a caller, Rob, said there's an effort underway to use a museum specimen DNA from a passenger pigeon to bring back the genome using a related species.
Well, I suppose that the mourning dove might be close enough to do that, because it does look very similar, although genetic work has indicated that another species of pigeon is more closely related. But I don't know if the technology is there to really do that at the moment. I suppose it will be one day, and probably one day soon. But if you do bring the passenger pigeon back, there's sort of nowhere for it to go, because, as I just said, it can't survive in small numbers.
Yeah.
So it can only survive in the billions. And much of the forest that it needed to live has now been chopped down to make room for humans. So there's kind of nowhere for it to go. So if you did reproduce it, all you could do would be to keep it in captivity, I think, and let it kind of reproduce itself in captivity if it could. But I don't think you could ever imagine wild flocks of passenger pigeons ever again, no.
No, and you wouldn't be, and you wouldn't have exactly the passenger pigeon either.
I suppose not. I mean, you know, maybe technology will be such at some time in the future that you could. I don't know. I think certainly in the foreseeable future, no, you wouldn't exactly have a passenger pigeon. And I mean, they're talking about doing this thing, sort of thing, with other extinct creatures, aren't they? Like the mammoth and the thing called a thylacine that comes from Tasmania that looked a bit like a wolf, but in fact was a marsupial.
Yeah.
But whether that will ever happen or not, I don't know.
Errol Fuller, our guest today. He is an acclaimed artist and writer, world authority on bird and animal extinction. And we'll be visiting with him right up till 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network. It's easy to feel helpless in the face of declining species and loss of habitats that they depend on. And I guess one of the most striking extinctions happened just 100 years ago in 1914 when the last passenger pigeon died. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're learning about that story and what you and I can take away from it from our guest, Errol Fuller. Errol's an acclaimed artist and writer, world authority on bird and animal extinction, and his most recent book is titled The Passenger Pigeon. Wonderful to have him with us today. He joins us from his home in England. Errol, thanks again for spending time with us today.
A pleasure.
Really, really great to have you with us. And I have a caller I want to mention, by the way. If you have a question or comment for our guest, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Email us otherwise at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's take a call. Terry from the UP has been waiting a long time. So, Terry, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hey, thanks, Larry. Love your show. Another great show. I listen all the time up here.
Appreciate it.
My question was the population being in the billions. I just wonder how the environment could sustain a population that large even before man came and started to disrupt it. Are there other bird populations that have that bigger population? If you speak to something like that, great.
Sure.
Well, I think the answer to that is probably we don't really know. But certainly the passenger pigeon seems to, well, clearly it did sustain itself in these vast numbers, and the enormous forests of North America were enough to sustain it. I think that's all we can say. There are other birds that live in vast numbers, but I don't think anything we know of lived in quite the same numbers as the passenger pigeon. So this really was an exceptional creature, and I suppose that's what makes its extinction in such a short space of time all the more amazing. But could those forests sustain it? Yes, they did, so they could. Would there be enough forest to sustain numbers like that now? No, there certainly wouldn't.
How did the, interesting to me, and maybe we don't know, but how did the Native Americans interact with the passenger pigeon? Actually, you wrote about that in your book.
Yeah, we do know a little. they seem to have come to a sort of a balance with the numbers, but I don't think this was because they were wonderful conservationists or anything of that kind. I think they killed as many birds as they could. But, of course, it's the coming of technological humans that really put an end to the passenger pigeon. I mean, the Europeans' capacity to shoot the things with their new technological weapons, guns and massive netting and all sorts of things of that kind, and then to distribute the dead birds by packing them off on trains to major centres like New York or Chicago or wherever else, enabled humans to consume these things at a vast rate. The Native American Indians, of course, could and would only want to feed their the local population. They weren't going to distribute dead birds, and they had no refrigeration methods either. They weren't going to distribute them all over the continent. So I think just a natural predator and prey balance was established, really.
Yeah. The author of what is considered to be, I think, maybe the definitive book on the passenger pigeon, he was from Wisconsin, Arlie Schorger.
He was, yes. And, I mean, that is the most valuable book on the passenger pigeon because Arlie Schorger, I think he published it in 1955, he did all the groundwork on research and located all manner of 19th century and earlier references. So he kind of put together a book that anyone that wants to know about the passenger pigeon or wants to write about the passenger pigeon has to read his book. Because of the time when he published it, reproduction of images was much more difficult or much more expensive. So in comparison to my book, you know, he's got nowhere near as many pictures.
Right.
But that wasn't his fault. That was to do with it. You know, I've had the advantage now of doing my book at this moment in time when it's relatively easy or relatively cheap to produce wonderful coloured images, but that wasn't available to Mr. Schorger. But his book certainly is the most important book that's been done on the passenger pigeon.
You know, you wonder how he became such an authority on the passenger pigeon, what kind of a guy he was.
Yeah, I don't know. He was an academic, and he spent many, many years visiting libraries, chasing up this lead, chasing up that lead, in a way that I, for instance, didn't need to, because in the last couple of decades we've had the internet, and it makes research so much easier.
Yeah.
You know, many sort of books that I might have wanted to consult are now online. You can just summon them up, and whereas poor Arlie Schorger had to travel, you know, all over the place to access this material.
Bob in Claybanks, thanks a lot for calling. Hello.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having the show.
Sure.
I was just curious, with the extinction of the passenger pigeon, was there any noticeable increases in populations of any other birds or any other animals?
Oh, so did other birds flourish or animals flourish when the passenger pigeon went down?
I don't know what evidence there is for that. I mean, it's something I haven't really, to be honest, I haven't thought about very much. I'm sure some birds would have taken advantage of the ecological niches that were left by the passenger pigeons. Obviously, they consumed vast amounts of material, and that material, or some of that material at least, would have been available to other birds and animals. But you've also got to remember that huge stands of forest were being chopped down at that time. So probably the total food supply was much less as well. So I think it's probably a bit doubtful if other creatures benefited in a significant way. At some local levels, I'm sure they did. But in a kind of national level, I don't know.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have on your book cover, on the back of your book cover, is a photo of a plaque that is from Wisconsin, Wisconsin Society for Ornithology.
That's right. And, well, Wisconsin was into publications about the passenger pigeon at a very early stage. I mean, I've got a booklet, and it's a very nice and thorough booklet called Silent Wings, A Memorial to the Passenger Pigeon, that was published in 1947 by the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. And it has, on the front cover of it, a sort of engraving of that engraving. But the whole monument that engraving is the central part of. So, Wisconsin was banging away at the passenger pigeon and its extinction 50, 60, 70 years ago.
It is, and I, if I just might read the what the plaque says, it says, dedicated to the last Wisconsin passenger pigeon shot at Babcock, September 1899. This species became extinct through the avarice and thoughtlessness of man.
Yeah, well, I suppose that about sums it up, really.
I think you're right. Were there people? Were there back at that time? Were there people that saw this coming?
Yeah, there were one or two that did see it coming, and I mentioned them in my book. And I can't off the top of my head remember the name of the man that mostly saw it coming. But there were several that actually tried to protect it, but their voices were very much drowned out by the fact that people sort of thought, well, but there are millions of them. There are millions and millions of them. So no one really took much notice. And when the birds vanished from a certain area, people understandably thought, oh, they've just gone somewhere else, because that's what they did. They were migratory. And they flew all over the place. You didn't know whether they would come next year or come in another 10 years. So people thought, oh, well, they haven't come for a year or two, but they've gone somewhere else. And, you know, it's easy now to look back and say, oh, they should have seen it coming, they should have seen it coming. But quite honestly, I hindsight is 20/20 vision, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I can understand why they didn't. But some people did, certainly, yeah.
You know, you're in your book, you have some wonderful photography and also photos of many just gorgeous paintings and art done on the passenger pigeon. Mm-hmm. Lewis Cross's Oil on Canvas is just so...
That is a very interesting one in Muskegon. I'm not sure, is that how you say it, Muskegon?
Muskegon, yeah.
Muskegon, is that how you say it, yeah. That's an interesting one, and a contemporary New York painter called Walton Ford has done a fabulous picture, a very emotional picture called Falling Bough, of hundreds of passenger pigeons on a branch and broke the branch breaking because they're so heavy. The most famous picture, of course, is the one that I actually put on the cover of my book by Audubon of a male and female kind of kissing almost, and it's that's a wonderful sort of image. But there are many.
Yeah, there are many. You know, the one thing that I didn't find, and I don't think I missed it in the book, was a photograph. It would have been so cool to have seen a photograph of the hundreds of, you know, or millions of birds in flight.
Yeah, there are none, or I'm saying there are none. There are certainly none that I've ever seen or been able to track down. None at all. But, of course, one of the reasons for that would have been that photography in the last decades even of the 19th century was much more complex than it is now.
Yeah.
I mean, you had to have whole heavy equipment. Basically, things had to be still for you to photograph them. You know, now we're completely spoiled with what we can do with cameras.
With your own telephone, or with your own phone.
Yeah, I mean, even in the last 20 years, I mean, what you can do on a mobile phone now, is it more sophisticated than what you could have done with a camera that cost perhaps $2,000 20 years ago, you know?
Yeah.
But then, back when there were flocks of these things, photographing them would have been very, very difficult, if not impossible.
Yeah.
But as far as I know, there are no images of that.
No. Love to see one. Dave in La Crosse, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. I was just wondering if in the last 50 years, some fairly extreme conservation measures have been taken to preserve birds like condors and whooping cranes. But I just wondered if anything like that is contemplated for small migratory birds like whippoorwills and meadowlarks. They're becoming pretty rare.
Well, the conservation movement, of course, has gathered enormous momentum in the last few decades in a way that it never did before. So I can't talk about specifics for those particular birds, but I'm sure that there are programs being organized for most things. But, you know, one of the ironies of conservation is that spectacular species like the condor, for instance, or like the tiger, get all this publicity and quite rightly get much attention. But sometimes the things that are perceived as less romantic or less spectacular get ignored. What can I say about that? You know, I suppose human beings, it's human nature, they will attend to the things that catch their attention and perhaps ignore others that are more deserving of attention.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Now, you're an expert on bird and animal extinction. Are there, as you think about it now, what are some species that you are really nervous about or worried about? Let me put it this way, most worried about?
Well, one that I'm particularly worried about is there are about six different species of it, but called the pangolin, which is a thing that lives in Asia and Africa. And the Chinese have taken to eating it. They find it a delicacy. The problem you have with these things is their only method of defense is to roll up into a ball, rather like a hedgehog. But unfortunately, they don't have any spikes. So they've got kind of scales, but the scales are smooth. So you can just walk along and pick them up. And hundreds of thousands of these things are being caught in places like India and Africa and shipped out to China where they're eaten. And because they're so easy to catch, the numbers are declining very, very rapidly. And I don't think many people are taking much notice of that. You know, people are obviously concerned about rhinos and things of that kind. But the poor little pangolin, no one knows or cares much about.
Mm.
And yet hundreds and hundreds of tons of them are being eaten every few months.
And the pangolin is what?
It's kind of a scaly mammal.
Okay.
Some are probably about the size of an armadillo, most of them, but then there is a giant one that's sort of two or three times as big as an armadillo. But they're rather like armadillos in a way. So they have, they're quite similar, sort of. I suppose they're the old world equivalent of an armadillo. I don't think they're particularly related, but they're kind of an equivalent sort of thing. And that's one animal. But then, of course, there are lots of creatures that are threatened, and the biggest threat to wild animals is, of course, habitat destruction. Jungles being chopped down, forests being chopped down. If you remove or destroy a place where an animal or a bird lives, then it will become extinct. Usually, and this isn't in all cases, but hunting as such doesn't result in extinction. It has in certain cases, but usually it doesn't. Usually it's habitat destruction that is the real cause of extinction.
Yeah. And in some ways, hunting has benefited. I'm thinking of Ducks Unlimited and organizations like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't. I mean, it obviously doesn't benefit the individual creature, but the species as a whole, it can often benefit. But as I say, if you ruin the place where an animal lives, then it really is all over. And because of the incredible overpopulation of the world, this is happening in so many parts of the world. I mean, not particularly in North America. There are other places that are even far worse affected.
A listener, Jim in Greenfield, sent a note, and he went to a talk by Stan Temple, who was a professor.
Oh, yeah.
You probably know him, the name at least.
I do know of him, yeah.
He said in his speech that Jill listened to that there are four different bills pending that would eliminate the Endangered Species Act. So people really need to be aware of that and on guard for that.
I don't know about that. So I can't speak about that. But yes, certainly people should be aware of that.
Yeah. Well, this has been wonderful talking with you today. Is there one lesson that we can take from your book? What would it be?
Well, I'm afraid there probably isn't a lesson to be learned for the passenger pigeon. The passenger pigeon was just never going to survive the coming of what I'll call technological man. But there are many creatures that can. In 4 years' time, there's another 100th anniversary, the extinction of the Carolina parakeet, which is another North American species. And that part possibly could have been saved if people had just been a bit more thoughtful and prepared to put more effort into thinking about the rate at which we're destroying ecosystems and just ruining the green places of the world, really.
Yeah. Well, this is, again, Errol, a real pleasure to have the opportunity to talk with you today. I very much appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
It's been a great... I've enjoyed it.
Well, I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you so much.
I hope so. Bye-bye.
Bye. Errol Fuller is an acclaimed artist and writer. He is a world authority on bird and animal extinction. He has lots of books. I should mention some of the others I haven't. Lost Animals, Extinction and the Photographic Record. Another is Extinct Birds, and another, Dodo, From Extinction to Icon. And his most recent book is The Passenger Pigeon. And with a lot of Wisconsin connections in it, and it's wonderful to have him with us today. He joined us from his home, actually, his home in England. So it's great having a chance to talk with him. And you know what? It's always great to have you listening in. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.